Right, thank you, Mike. This is the part of the meeting where I start to feel alienated. I hope Mike doesn't mind that I only gave him half-hearted applause. The reason for that is because he's due to speak tomorrow, and I didn't want to use up his full quote.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you.
So the spotlight of alienation now falls on you lot. This is where you have to earn your money. anybody would like to make any comments, any suggestions, anything on what Mike said? Bill.
I was reminded of one of its one-word titles, and it was based on a true story that was, I think it came out earlier this year. And in the United States, in the 1990s, I think it was, there was a prank phone caller. And what he would do is he'd ring up fast food restaurants, and he would persuade them that one of their colleagues was a thief and he was the police. And he would persuade managers to strip search young female staff while he was listening in on the phone. Apparently he got away with this about 9 or 10 times, and through a combination of being able to persuade them that he was a person in authority. And if you watch the film, he then goes between threatening authority and then trying to persuade people to make life easy for other people. So this whole idea of an organisation, please don't make my life difficult, just, you know, knuckle down and get on with it for me, if not for yourself, and this sort of thing. And it seems to be a fairly effective illustration of the way in which people who are alienated at work, to the point that they're no longer taking responsibility for their own actions, they just do what someone supposedly higher up in the chain of command will ask them to do, even if it is completely and totally unreasonable in terms of the point of criminality in themselves, because they think that someone else says, well, I'll take the blame, I'll take the responsibility for this. And if I can remember the damn name of the film, it's certainly worth looking out for. I think if you just go to Wikipedia and look for prank phone calls, or Wendy's prank phone calls, I think it was, the case, it's relatively notorious. That should look.
Dave.
I mean, when you talk about this thing about people conforming to norms and even in a way sort of accepting hierarchical positions from above, isn't it actually something sort of potentially like quite communistic in that, in the way people want to get along with everybody else and not be an outsider and different? It isn't quite a cohesive feeling, isn't it? Rather than just something that's to do with. I mean, obviously in capitalism it comes across as obedience to authority, but I mean, if we were living in a communist society, there could be something positive about people not being awkward or difficult, or being a recalcitrant minority or whatever, like refusing to volunteer to work, for instance. And the peer pressure that would be put under them to sort of be reasonable.
Yeah, I suppose that could happen depending on the sort of the individual culture, but I don't know. I suppose it's hard to predict. Did you mean communist as in?
Well, if we were living in like free access society, some people do use that argument, and then people will say, well, some people, you know, just wouldn't work and would take too much and all the rest of it, and then presumably some kind of peer pressure on them, wouldn't it?
Well,
like them. Or do people just start behaving in an antisocial fashion?
I suppose the sort of the stock answer for that is that kind of behaviour is sort of capitalist behaviour, which we're projecting onto a non-capitalist society. I suppose that's sort of the easy answer, isn't it, to say that that kind of peer pressure isn't sort of inherent in us as people, but it's sort of encouraged by capitalism, I suppose. That's what I asked.
Simon first.
Yeah, there's always been at least two ways of looking at alienation in sort of like Marxist traditions. Number one is the very sort of like, you know, mechanistic look of like, you know, you produce a good and then like someone else takes it, yeah? Which is, and that is simply about the struggle for, you know, physical survival, yeah? Which is, you know, sort of like, you know, what that then argues is it says, well, there's no real place in order to invest your emotional structure within that environment, if you like. If it's you, you're basically you're crying in the playground after the bully's taking your lunch money.
Yeah.
It's your problem that you're weeping because you can't stand the world is hell. Yeah? And there is a very there is this like a pragmatic strand through it, which is very much dependent on that crude materialist approach of like the late 19th century, which was not Marx's approach, but was the Engels and subsequent approach, the Bolshevik approach, etc., which was like what they thought was hard materialism. Yeah. So you've got that one side of alienation, which is physical goods being removed. There's the more sophisticated approach, which I think is Marx's one, because it marks the situation dialectics. Now, the way this one works is that collectively we are worlds of the sort of made. So like, when we talk about the world, we talk about what is going on in our minds. Yeah? So like, we are basically the sum total of the things that happen to us and everything that's going on around us. So what that means now is, instead of this simply being a struggle for the survival of the organisation, this is about our existence itself. Yeah? So when you produce something, you are basically within your own world, you're externalising part of yourself. But it still has invested in it all of your all of your emotions, all your hopes and feelings about the world. Are then put into that thing that you created, like a new concept in your world, which then is cruelly ripped away from you by someone else. So now it is no longer simply a matter of physical survival. It's a matter that your own life story has become a dystopia. If you sort of mean, you are now living in a hell that is you. Yeah. So again, when you look at people that you are alienated from, because you treat them in this alienated manner, I buy your services, I buy your good or whatever. If you're a grocer, I'm such and such, and you're trying to build me out of money and whatever. Now, again, in that crude materialist perspective, it doesn't matter on a on an emotional level. It's just a survival level. It's like, once we've done all that, we can go away and we can discuss how well we screwed each other over in the pub. Yeah? But if you look at it from this more sophisticated angle, saying, well, we are the sum total of what's going on in our lives, then basically you have invested your own emotions into that person, and you are destroying yourself as you destroy what you think of them. As they betray you, you betray yourself, is what I mean. Yeah? So alienation becomes basically a destruction of your very being. Yeah. So all I'm trying to say is that there's a much more powerful approach that is in Marx's early writings. And incidentally, the only people who protested Marx's early writings are those people who took that to a more mechanical view. Their Bolshevik world is gone, and we should be burying that. Yeah. So those people have gone. We should be going back to Marx's early writings, especially like Eco-Philosophical Manuscripts and excerpts from James Mill, which you know I keep trotting out year on year. Yeah. But we should be trying to take up this more sophisticated approach in what we have to say about alienation. Now, I think you've done well on that today. Yeah, but I think really we need to keep pushing this. It's not just about the money, it's about life.
Just quickly, nice to hear you say that you'd like my talk, Simon. I think last time you said that you disagreed with everything that I said last time I gave a talk, which I've nearly forgiven you for. One thing which, just quickly, I think you used the term sort of destruction of being, in that capitalist sort of work sort of destroys our being, or words to that effect. I'd put it a bit differently, and I'd say that it's not a destruction, it's more of a sort of a recreation, if you like, or bits of us, not all of us, are sort of created from outside influences, but it's probably just a similar way of saying what you were saying. I'm not sure if alienation destroys parts of us. I'd say it more sort of rearranges them in its own form. It's like taking apart a Lego, I think you used a Lego analogy earlier, take apart a Lego structure and then rebuild it in a slightly different way.
The way I would see it is, I would see it from like where you regarded, and you would say it was a negative impact. It's like, it's the mental equivalent of having an arm or a leg removed. That's how you are, that's just how you live. Yeah. But before that, if someone said, do you want me to rip your arm off, you'd say no. And alienation is pretty much like that. You end up continuing on, but as a reduced creature.
There's three lined up at the moment. There's Dougie, then Vince, then Kevin. Dougie, if you'd like to...
Yeah, interesting. Doug, I think alienation starts in school, right? You know, when the teacher's authority and kids forming their own groups and bullying other kids. And there was one guy at our school who was bullied on a school cruise, and he was going to jump into the water in the Mediterranean, you know, because of all the terrible bullying. And the same guy got a job by ICI when I was working there. And he was much happier in the workplace than he had been in school, because in school they made his life hell, right? Mm. Yeah. And ICI at that time, it wasn't that bad a company to work for. I know the bipolar tours and all the rest of it, but they were reasonable. It was probably the best job I had, you know, because you could take 2 hours and go and play football at lunchtime. It was very relaxed, right? Yeah. So the workplace is not always that bad. Sometimes school and people's experience of school can be a nightmare, really, and it's part of the alienation that goes on from the start. You know, when children are taught this is what we've got to do, you know, and school fails about, you know, 80% of kids, they're kind of told it's stupid and they're in the lower section, and you know, the only hope they've got is becoming a plumber or a joiner or whatever. They're not going to go down the academic route, right, you know. Mm. And it kind of channels people into these jobs that are alienated in the future. So I think it all starts in school, really, you
know. Vince?
Yeah.
So, obviously, we've been having a look at the general features of alienation in the workplace and how people have often very clearly defined roles and expectations from work. I just thought it might be interesting to look at a part of my work experience. I was working in the computer industry from 1979 to 1923, and my experiences were the variation of how people perform their roles within, obviously, a capitalist organisation, and how they express their personalities. Now, at that time, there was a large demand for computer workers, and unemployment was at a relatively low level in the late 70s, early 90s, compared with what it is now. And I was working in local government, Gloucestershire County Council, and there were quite a high degree of union activity. People can talk about their politics, or at least some people would. There were a couple of members of the Communist Party as well. Again, they would talk quite a lot about politics, as well as performing their usual job role, all within the self-contained computer department. Obviously, their reaction towards their customers, if you like, where it had to be different when they were going to other departments. But the interesting thing was how things changed over that period from 79 to 93. Privatisation was introduced in 1990, and what had previously been a relatively liberal set of working conditions within terms of capitalism, completely, as I say, completely changed, in that you had project daily logs, which were imposed by this private company. You had to have a code for each piece of work you were doing, and you had to write down the time you started the work, the time you finished it, and all this sort of thing. When I just explained this to a friend of mine who lives in Russia, she said that it reminded her of what they got under the old Stalin regime in Russia. So, I mean, it just goes to show, although we've got these general rules of capitalist employment which make us feel alienated, that there are varying conditions. But one other thing I would say is that one of the people I was just talking about about and openly admitted being a member of the Communist Party. The irony of it was that he was a senior systems analyst, and when the first round of redundancies came about, he was not made redundant. He was one of the managers that was making other people redundant. So I suppose it's a prime example of alienation. Obviously, I know we've got all our differences with people who were in the Communist Party, etc. But nevertheless, quite clearly, he was critical of aspects of capitalism. And yet, there was a person who was really alienated in the sense that he was being forced to do distasteful tasks.
Mike, I'd like to not address all of your talk because I won't be able to do it. I'd like to actually focus on two films, which I think actually touch on alienation. The first one is the film that Charlie Chaplin was in, for the title of it now, when he's in the workplace. Modern Times, yeah, Modern Times, which is, I think, touches on Fordism a little bit. But what we have here is a man, the worker, he goes to the place of work, which is a conveyor belt. He's got no control over the time of the conveyor belt, how it takes to get the object from A to Z. Sometimes he's speeded up when he's running around. The end of this film shows him completely caught up in the machine. So he's become an appendage to the machine. He's no longer in charge of the machine. He's alienated from the process from the very start because the time is not his own. The graphic business of him being in the machine, I think, is very good. But at the end of it, he doesn't even have the product. The product's been sold on someone else to someone he doesn't know, probably anywhere in the world. So this shows the alienation, the alienated process of capitalist production. He's got no control over the speed of the job. He's got no control of where he works on the conveyor belt. And in the end, you know, he's locked in the machine. The second one is Groundhog Day, which really deals about the alienation of life, in a sense. This in the film Bill Murray, he continually embraces throughout the same day without any change in it until, of course, in the film. This is the life of a lot of workers in canneries, production lines. They continually go through the same day, every day, having breaks at the same time, having the same conversations at the same time, and going back to the same wife or boyfriend. And so life is constantly unrewarding. But that's the life of a lot of people under capitalism. The third one, which I won't strain too much, is not a film. It's actually a story. It's a book. It's a novel by Albert Camus, The Myth of Sisyphus. Because, like me, I favoured Fountains of Corinth rather than pay homage to the gods. And because I put Death in Chains and look so young, this is why they've given me this awful toil of putting this boulder up the hill. And so when in the morning I wake up, it's back down and I repeat that task. And I think sometimes life's like that. We continue to have to complete futile and endless tasks. But in some ways we find our humility and our dignity in doing tasks that we don't actually want to do. So that's my piece.
It's a good point, yeah, because I suppose that sort of repetitious type of work, that sort of, as you say, you're an appendage of the machine. You're sort of a part of the machine, in that the rest of it is like a, you know, cogs fitting together. Yeah, I've only seen Groundhog Day, and I didn't really have that interpretation of it. So yeah, I'll have to catch up with Modern Times and Myth of Sisyphus. So yeah, thanks for that.
Comrade from Wolverhampton. Good to see you.
I enjoyed the breakdown of alienation and how it affects us. That was interesting. Now, I've got one question and one comment. The question is, are you expressing alienation as simply, is it simply a general term, or do you see different forms of alienation? Because I was wondering if you saw a historical context to it in different forms of society, and different class societies, and so whether you would identify differences there. Second point, I think I'd just like to add the idea that a coping, it's not really a solution, but it's the seeds of the solution, the coping mechanism, and the way it's things I've seen in practice is in struggle, how people come together, people close up together, and the differences of role, the differences of personality and so forth come to matter less. When the working class starts to struggle, then these things are pushed aside, and I think that's the seeds for a future society, a genuine socialism, that common element that comes out of the struggle and the fight for socialism.
With the historical context, I suppose I sort of neglected to take that into account. Really, I just sort of focused on things as they have been for the last, I don't know, 100 years.
Working capitalism.
Yeah. So, I don't know if alienation as a concept, you can apply it in the same way to feudalism and early societies. You probably can't. Not in the same way. There was different types of alienation. And of course, as I put most emphasis on alienation from other people, then that means, you know, I didn't dwell too much on alienation from products of labour or alienation from the actual workplace. So, I suppose if the talk had had sort of a wider scope, then I should have thought of that a bit more. As for what you said about learning through struggle, I suppose it depends in what form that struggle takes and what direction it goes, because you could say that a struggle, I don't know, if the workers in an organisation just struggle for higher wages, for example, then that's a sort of a very narrow focus of that struggle, and you know, I'll say that leads up to a cul-de-sac. So again, it depends how that struggle is directed as to whether or not it can really combat alienation, and I suppose it's the whole reform versus revolution angle in a different way. You know, it depends how you focus that struggle.
Okay, Paul first, then Kevin.
Yeah, not good. When Conrad Dean was talking about films, there's a rather unusual film that I'd probably recommend in all things. It's a rather cheesy Disney movie, and it's called B-Movie. Mm. And it's a traditional Disney film. It's a love story, but unusual kind of twist. You know, this bee sort of escapes from a hive, falls in love with a human. But it's well worth watching because it just sort of describes it in the way, you know, there's this kind of underlying sort of political content of it, and the alienation, the structure, the hierarchy of the beehive, how this bee is born, and it sort of takes you right through the, you know, the process and sort of translates it into the sort of human element of the story. And it's worth checking out if you ever get the chance. You know, having children, it's anything. Good excuse to watch it, but check out Walt Disney B-Movie. Oh. And it's a terrific, very simplistic message, and something we could all relate to, you know. And it's well worth watching. I'm sure you wouldn't be disappointed. And needless to say, it has a happy ending. we didn't quite get as far as socialism in it, but one or two people get their bum stung. But it's well worth watching. Trust me, you're able to relate everything that you described today. Whoever, you know, produced the film, obviously very politically switched on.
I didn't realise Disney was so subversive.
Yeah. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. No, it's well watched. It's a good film. Have you seen it?
Yeah,
it's terrific, isn't it?
So actually, say something and then ask for a comment from Mike. Very often when people are at work and they're doing unremitting, boring tasks, people will say to them, well, at least you've got a job, and therein we have the money, arguably to support ourselves and do the pub or go shop, whatever the things that actually make our life more enriching. But it interests me, what happens when the job folds, you don't have the job for illness or whatever, you don't have the job anymore. Those things that you may have found unfulfilling and just put up with, suddenly you're out of the range of the people you used to mix with at work. You've got less money. Your social life starts to drop. Then what happens is, if you read Durkheim, you become in a state of anomie, that you are not connected. You've lost your norms. And in a sense, I think this is one of the most alienating processes that happens to people, that when they're removed from the workplace, even though you might regard it as boring, when they suffer reversal of fortune or the type of lifestyle they're living, they fall into this state of anomie. You know, if
I'd quite like you to sort of comment on that. The awful disruption that goes onto people, even though capitalism may supply a lot of awful jobs, it's even worse when we're not working.
Well, I think you're right. Yeah, because, as I say, even a boring job provides some structure and some routine and other people to speak with. And the way that capitalism encourages us to invest so much of our identity in our job, as you say, when the rug's pulled from under you, if someone hasn't sort of got other things in their life, then they find themselves in that awkward position. And I suppose, yeah, that's sort of symptomatic of how capitalism sort of dumps people on the scrap heap once they stop being productive, whether it's due to age or due to health or redundancy. I probably should have covered that.
I think you covered quite a lot, but it just struck me.
Good point, because even if a job does alienate you, it gives you some sort of identity
connection.
If you haven't got something else to replace that, then you come apart.
Richard, then Jacqueline, Bill and Peter.
I've been watching what's going on in my own workplace over the last 5 years, which has been really quite interesting. Because a few years ago, we were part of my best work, public service, was hived off into a separate organisation, which was given a different hierarchy and started to work in a different way. And instead of actually having a very hierarchical structure, which we had originally, which did not communicate with staff, which just put people in their little boxes, told them what to do, even managers weren't allowed to manage, everything had to go up in the hierarchy and decisions had to come down, very hierarchical structure. People were really they did their job, they went home. It was a fairly bland environment. People would grumble in the corners. We set up a new organization was set up, and different management came in. And the new HR department took on board this idea that if you can actually get the workforce on board, it's almost like having a third larger workforce. So, so-called progressive organizations have realized that alienation, actually is not good in this workforce because it actually lowers productivity. So some organisations like this try to improve it. So we suddenly started having welfare organisations. Well, it was sort of days. I mean, there wasn't any day when jigsaws appeared in on tables all around the offices, so that people when people sort of got to the point where they're tearing their hair out, they're like, they're going to spend 5 minutes doing the jigsaw to come back. It was. But I will tell you, the mood in the place just literally soared. Going from a really kind of bored, boring place, people were engaging, it was happier, it was friendlier, people were sort of chatting, and everyone was actually enjoying themselves, and productivity did go up. So I think, as I say, more progressive type workplaces actually do understand alienation, and that the alienation they caused, and want to do something about them. We were then taken back into the original organisation, back to the hierarchical structure. Morale, mood just plummeted, just completely just went. There was antagonism and everything. And the second thing that was actually happening during all that time was the Condemned Welfare. And being public service, a lot of people go into public service with a public service ethos. They actually want to go in and do something useful. And they are prepared to accept lower wages, which is generally in public service, in order to do that. But what I actually noticed was that as the recession hit, and as our job became much more constrained, instead of providing services for people, we were cutting down services. So I noticed the attitudes of all my colleagues started to change as well. So from having a generous spirited attitude towards our customers, which we have to call them, they started to say things like, I better just trying it on. he's a lazy devil, you know, why should we give something to him? And so actually what starts to happen was that as the economy kind of sort of contracted, so people's attitudes contracted as well as their capacity to actually help other people. And what I further noticed from that was that as that contraction took place in people's attitudes, so the levels of stress went up. The levels of antagonism and the levels of stress went up in terms of their relationship with the world around them and within the organisation. And finally, the only other thing I'd like to say about that is that one of the other things I noticed is that even when we were in this kind of this hived-off organisation where we had all this kind of staff-friendly type of activity, and people were actually happy in their work and much more in terms of the day-to-day, the smiling faces, I nevertheless noticed that if you ask somebody, how are you feeling? You would often get one of two answers. One was, oh, pretty good, it's Friday afternoon, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Or, well, what do you expect? It's Monday morning. Yeah. So even behind that, you still got the sense that we're coming to work with something that they really necessarily kind of just there was a level of resentment about their having to be there. And that was palpable. You see that all the time. On Kevin's point about unemployment, in a sense, because unemployment, because of the nature of capitalist society, you can only fulfil yourself as a productive member of the community in a work situation. So capitalism restricts when you can be a productive member of society. So chucking you out of work in capitalism is in itself a further form of alienation from your kind of from the social, well, what social collective productive social life we have can only be within these constraints. So when it chucks you out, it's just a further level of the same sort of process. So that was just a conservation I wanted to make.
Jacqueline?
Well, thank you very much for your talk, Mike, which I do like a bit of alienation. It gets the blood going. I've appreciated stuff from the audience, from comrades, friends, visitors. But employment. Now, having been there myself, like everybody else, and always horrible, employment is the capitalist way of having us doing what they want us to tell us, doing things we don't want to do usually, we have no interest in, for someone else who's got no interest in it, but probably has the commodity to pay for it, the ultimate commodity. Work, of course, is a pleasure, and I'm a big William Morris fan. Don't like the wallpaper, but I liked his things about arts and crafts. I liked his talk about work should be a pleasure, a joy. When we go out within socialism, of course, you know, gardening or building something, we will be creative. We will be putting our best into it. And I really believe and understand that and want to do it, want to be part of that, rather than the shoddy, built-in, obsolete, tack, crappy commodities that we churn out every day for each other. Now, work and employment. Employment, capitalism. Work, socialism. We all work, whether we've been thrown out of employment, we go home or we go to our corner on the street or wherever it is we're allowed to dwell in capitalism and we do something. Or we care maybe for an animal, not necessarily a dog, or we have someone who we talk to. We have our own way of connecting to another human. And that's all I really wanted to say, to be honest. Just looking forward to socialism and work, creative work, pleasure and joy.
Okay, Bill?
Just two quick things. First up, managed to get the name of the film I was talking about. It's called Compliance.
There's a bell.
If anyone wants to check that out, useful. And just something we talked about earlier about some of the pressures of in the workplace could be possibly those pressures that are conducive to good community. But of course, the part of the whole point about alienation is it is the employers taking our cultural communal impulses and using them towards their own ends of producing their products instead of for us to produce a community for ourselves. And I would say, even in terms of the workplace Richard was describing, when you have a happy workplace where everyone feels more in tune with the work and are more productive, that strikes me as being the ultimate in alienation. because they've managed to get us to be in tune and take our so we see ourselves as doing the work rather than as ends in ourselves. I think that was kind of where I was going with what I said the first time.
Okay, Peter, then Fraser.
Well, technically it's the same sort of things that Cummins here has been talking about, where you become unemployed and things like that, which is a form of alienation. But what comes to my mind with all this talk about the work and how we produce things and all the rest of it, but so what? In the short lifetime that I've had, we've doubled or tripled the production in things, and they tell us we'll have to work now that we're 70 and things like that. But we're constantly left in the same position. And alienation surely is that particular side that Cummins is talking about. We don't really share in the wealth that we're producing. We're certainly consumer, but we don't necessarily share in it. It's a capitalist system, and it's operating in their interest. So all the sort of activity and cooperation and all the rest of it, it's all there to produce more. But for what reason? Because there's no real way that it's giving us anything back. Because they're telling us now we're going to work longer because we can't operate. In spite of the fact, we're going to work longer and we've got stacks of folk unemployed. It's 25% in Spain and all. So this goes on and on and on. So that's your alienation, surely. The system itself alienates us. Because we're no part of something that's in our benefit. It's in the benefit of somebody else, a certain class.